We start tonight our class, a section in church history that really begins to directly relate to what happens with the New Testament church in America as we begin to approach a period that historically is referred to as the Restoration Movement among churches in America. And it's a fascinating story to look at. And I know that many of you have looked at parts of it before, and I hope that we'll look at some things that will be helpful for further study for you, as well as introducing people to a period of religious history in America that is very important to us as New Testament Christians. Again, remember, if you have a question, comment, feel free to unmute yourself and speak up, or you can click on the chat window, chat there at the, below at the bottom of our Zoom window, click there and open the chat box, and you can make comments or ask questions there as we go along. And I certainly welcome them. I get wound up and forget to pause for those, so don't hesitate to interrupt me or type something in. I'll be glad for you to do it. Well, settings of movements is important. I've talked about that before. We've been setting the stage for the time period that we're approaching now in Europe and in England and Scotland, particularly because things that have been happening there in the late 1700s are directly related to things that begin to happen in America in the late 1700s and 1800s. We are in a period in American history that we are just on the cusp of the new nation of the United States of America. Having declared our independence in 1776, the Articles of Confederation are later passed, and I believe it's in 1794, I believe, before the U.S. Constitution is fully ratified. So we are just at the very beginnings of our nation. The estimated population of the American colonies at the time of the Declaration of Independence is said to have been about 2.5 million. By the time we get to 1800, the time where we're really looking at beginning tonight, it's already doubled in size to over 5.3 million. And this most important period of Restoration history we're going to look at from 1800 to 1850, it will grow from that 5.3 million to 23 million. By 1850. In 1800, we're looking at a country that by then is made up of just 16 states. By 1850, there will be 31 states and 4 recognized territories. Here's the world that we're looking at. I put this map in our lesson on the front page. I know it's small. You may need a magnifying glass to look at it. So I'll put it a little bigger here for us to understand the world that we're thinking about. You know, whenever we hear someone talk about the great American frontier, we immediately think of the cowboys out west. But you have to remember in the beginning, when at the time that we're talking about, around 1800 and thereabouts, the United States only went to the Mississippi River. And once you cross there, you were actually in French territory. The Spaniards sold it to France in 1803. And of course, we later buy it from them, the Louisiana Purchase. But this is the frontier right here. You cross the Appalachians, you're in the frontier in this area. You're in the world of Daniel Boone and David Crockett, both who died. Boone died in 1820, and David Crockett died in 1834. Do you know where he died? See if anybody, okay, he died in the Alamo, if you've forgotten that. But this is their time, and we're talking about a very rugged time, but it's a time where settlers are pouring over the mountains into the Western Reserve, this area up here, and into Kentucky, and filling up the land with a great population shift. Major part of the population shift is a people who have little land or little prospects back in the colonies. They're going west to try to establish their own piece of land and to develop and start a new world for themselves. They're very independent and pioneering spirit. These are the kind of people that they are. And the restoration movement, as we see it, really takes root in these areas, even beginning up in here, down in Western Virginia, and then over into Kentucky. So there is a setting, there is a background for the very things that are happening here that we're talking about. And it is a time in the frontier of a great spiritual awakening, a religious revival. The traditional picture is that it's only in recent decades that the United States has become a non-Christian nation. Before that, it was a solid block of people who believed in Christianity and committed to its principles. That's really never been true. But there are times when certainly Christianity and the views of Christendom have dominated the political scene and the direction that the nation took. In fact, it has the lead in that sense for the greater part of the history of the country. But the idea that most people were dedicated followers of God is simply not the picture that is true. Religious fervor fell off pretty quickly in this country after the Revolutionary War was over and more affluent times were coming. I have a quotation in here from W. Garrison, well-known Restoration historian. He wrote that there was probably never a time when there was as large a percentage, not only of religious indifference, but of active hostility to religion as during the last two decades of the 18th century, that is the late 1700s. So it didn't take long for religious fervor to die away after the war. But there is a spiritual awakening that does take place. There had been one that taken place back in the 1740s. It had faded out, but now one starts to take place here on what is called the Western Frontier, or the Western Reserve. And out of this religious movement will come a lot of new churches, a lot of movements. In a time of high religious fervor, often you will have groups that come out of it that are quite radical. This happened during this time. What comes out of this spiritual awakening that we're talking about here and, on the frontier, you're going to have some unusual groups come out of that. We're going to have a period during this time period, the development of the Mormons and the Shakers, the Adventists, the Rappites, which are a communal group that come out of Germany that believe in actually establishing a commune. Some of these other groups, like the Shakers and others, they come out for moral purity to the point that they believe in celibacy for all members, which pretty much guarantees that these groups are going to die out, which they do. But they're very radical, very conservative in a lot of ways. And there are other groups like this that come out of this time. But it's also a time where other conservative religious groups really grow. The Methodists do. And the Baptists do. There are more conservative Presbyterian groups that grow during this time. And it's during this time then that what is often referred to as the Disciples of Christ movement begins. Out of the Disciples of Christ movement comes the Churches of Christ, the Disciples of Christ, and the Christian Church, the Christian churches, which really now are three different groups that come out of this heritage during that time. So the setting is one which is going to produce a lot of religious fervor and a lot of spreading and preaching, Bible preaching during this time throughout this era. There are a lot of things that are just right to produce this kind of growth. I mentioned before, if you read a lot of liberal historians, basically what they say about religious development is it just kind of develops to meet whatever the need of the people is at the time. that if more liberal ideas are being followed in the culture, then people want a more liberal church, and so on. So whatever churches are at a certain time, it's just whatever the culture dictates. There's no doubt that culture influences churches tremendously. But it suggests that, for example, the development of New Testament churches in the United States in the 1800s was simply because it's what the culture wanted, I think is to do a disservice to what so many of these believed and taught, and to the principles of the evangelistic principles of New Testament Christianity. There's no doubt the setting was good. Anytime you have a place where there is freedom of religion, absence of religious persecution, where there are democratic principles in the minds of the people, and you have the ready availability of scriptures to all people, when you have those kinds of things going on, then you have certainly fertile soil for New Testament Christianity to truly grow. And that's what you have during this time period. So not to say the New Testament church didn't exist, but to say that at that particular time in the United States, because of all that was going on here, it was a perfect time for the expansion of these ideas and for the mindset of people to want to return to biblical New Testament Christianity. They were reading the Bibles for themselves. They, like the reformers in reading the Bibles, were seeing that the churches of which they were a part were not following what the Bible said. Just as the reformers saw when they read the Bible, the Catholic Church was not following what they saw the Bible say. And when religious people began to do that, and as we've seen all through this history we've looked at, when religious people do that, when they're reading the Bible on their own and have truly spiritually minded people, they start questioning the religious authorities and begin making the appeal to go back to the Bible. So this is what begins to happen. So during this time, there is a real shift in the size of a lot of the churches during this time. The more established old line denominations to a great extent begin to decrease in number. The more conservative, what historians would call fundamentalist type groups, begin to grow and to fill the population very quickly. Again, on the second page of our lesson, I list there the change in order of size of denominations back during this time. In 1800, the largest denominations in order were Congregationalists, Presbyterian, Baptist, Episcopalian, Lutheran, Reformed, Quaker, German sectaries, which were some German sects, and Methodists. By 1850, the Methodists were now at the top. Baptists were second. Presbyterians had dropped a third and were very split. Congregationalists had moved down, so were Lutherans. But after only about 20 years, the Disciples of Christ were already sixth on the list with over 118,000 members and had surpassed the Episcopalians, which had been fourth on the list. Back in 1800. Now, these groups are rising, and you have to understand at this time, Methodism was very conservative, very evangelistic in nature. The influence of John Charles Wesley in this country had a tremendous effect. We haven't looked a lot at the development of Methodism, but it has a tremendous effect in this country and becomes a very strong denomination because of their work, and as I said, very evangelistic during this time. But these groups are rising to the fore. I think one of the great examples of what happens is what is seen in the great revival, considered the greatest revival of this great awakening period, which was the Cane Ridge Revival. Cane Ridge, let me switch screens again. Cane Ridge is in eastern Kentucky. Would have been, let's see, northeast of Lexington, along in here is where Cane Ridge is. in the hills of eastern Kentucky. There was a small church building there, the Cane Ridge. It was identified as Presbyterian. And in 1800, it had a young pastor by the name of Barton W. Stone. Stone was a young, studious, very spiritually minded young Presbyterian minister who became became disturbed by many of the things he saw the Presbyterian church preaching, with which he could not agree. He was instrumental in the Cambridge revival taking place in 1801. This picture of the original Cambridge meeting house is actually from about 1934. So it was already over 140 years old at that time. It is now encased in a large stone building, preserved because it's seen by many as the beginning place of the Disciples of Christ movement. And it's well preserved. I've been in there, and very simple, very plain, but held more people than you'd think it would. But nothing like the number of people who came to the Cambridge Revival. It wasn't unusual during those times for people to know of a weekend camp meeting that was going to take place in a certain area. And people would plan to travel 2 or 3 days to get to one of these weekend camp revivals. They would start on Friday and would usually end after Sunday communion. So see folks, 250 years ago, they were having weekend gospel meetings just like we do now. But they would come together and they would camp out and they would have these large revivals. Cane Ridge was one of the largest of all. It was just the right place at the right time. Barton W. Stone had been inspired by James McCready, who was one of the most well-known and powerful Presbyterian evangelists during that time, who had helped develop this idea of revival camp meetings. And so Stone has this one at Cane Ridge, at which there are 18 Presbyterian preachers and also a handful of Baptist and Methodist preachers. And they would gather not just at the building, but in the fields and the woods around the building, setting up temporary pulpits. And there may be a half dozen preachers preaching at one time with groups all around. And they would preach all day and into the night, the next day and into the night. And then on Sunday, they would have Sunday communion together. People would turn back home. This one was so successful, the people didn't go home. They stayed till the following weekend. And really, they say only broke up then because they ran out of provisions. People didn't have any more food, and so they left. It had far-reaching effects. Many people stirred to greater spiritual fervor churches being established out of Cane Ridge and out of other revival meetings such as this. But these were the things that were taking place on the frontier, the kind of revival preaching you would never see back in the staid colonies on the East Coast. There's a different kind of people to some extent over here. These are the more the common people out on the frontier. You still have the elite and the wealthy class back on the East for the most part. In fact, divisions are taking place along those social economic lines. One of the interesting ones that takes place in the Presbyterian Church has to do with the Cumberland Presbyterians. The Cumberland Presbyterian Church really formed out western Nashville, Tennessee, out of Dixon County. The original Cumberland Presbyterian Church buildings there, I've been there. And the reason it broke off from the Presbyterian Church in the United States of America, as the other was called, was over ordaining of preachers. The churches in the Cumberland area couldn't afford and couldn't get educated preachers who had been trained in seminaries and all that to come there and preach. And so they started appointing their own preachers. Well, the head synod disapproved of that, and finally, the brethren in this Cumberland area separated themselves and started appointing their own preachers. Well, that is a break over a class break, you might say, but it has to do with different levels in society not being able to work together within a denomination. But that's very, you can see then exactly what's happening or who's making up the churches out on the frontier. It shouldn't surprise us. And it's in that setting, within that, that you begin to have, again, the conservative, more fundamental idea of Scripture and Scripture alone, truly appealing to the people. People who have, to a great extent, broken away from the old mainline formal denominationalism of Episcopalian, Anglican, those who are Lutheran, and have come into the West, and many of them not even practicing much religion anymore, and being affected and moved by what's happening here in this area. This is then the beginning, the setting for what we call the Restoration Movement. The other thing that that is a major factor in people breaking off going into the Restoration Principle is the problem of this division within the denominations, as I just illustrated with the Cumberland Presbyterian. When Thomas Campbell came to America in 1807, he came from a Presbyterian church in Scotland that was very divided, had been for some time. He was a part of the Seceder Presbyterian Church, and you pretty much guess what Seceder stood for. It had seceded from the mainline Presbyterian Church, but there was a synod of them in America, and he applied for that to get a license to preach in America when he came. But he was very upset and dissatisfied with the division within Presbyterianism, and hadn't even been a part of a unity movement back in Scotland before he came. So that also plays a major role in the dissatisfaction among many church leaders and preachers who wanted to say, why do we have to be so divided? On what can we unite and remove all this faction and division? And out of that also comes the plea, we need to just do away with the creeds of men, and let's just go back and follow the Bible alone. So that's going to play another major role in this. The acrimony and the factiousness that existed within the denominations themselves. What are we talking about when we talk about a restoration movement? Well, I say in our lesson, the restoration movement is a term used by religious historians to describe a primarily American movement that sought to unite all Christians on the Bible alone and thereby restore the church to its first century primitive form. Sometimes we talk about primitive New Testament Christianity. The word primitive is usually used in our culture today as a derogatory term, and that's not the way it's used here, or historians using it that way. They use it rather to refer to the idea of simpler, that which is simpler than what you might see in the time in which they're living. Primitive New Testament Christianity means to go back to the simpler form and teaching of the church in the first century. That's the idea. And so this is what they're pleading for, a return to primitive New Testament Christianity, to the primary, basic New Testament Christianity. And the movement appears in America really in several different places at once. The traditional idea that when Alexander Campbell came to America, he started the Church of Christ is a terrible misrepresentation of what actually happened. Do understand the role that primarily Alexander Campbell played in the spread of the restoration idea is tremendous. But he is not alone, and he is preceded by others. But he ends up being in the right place, the right time, and being the right man to have this tremendous influence that he did. And we want to examine him. But they are going to seek out this idea of restoration instead of reformation. And they want to do it on the idea of restoring the church to what it was in the first century. Now, that's not a new idea. I mean, if you go back and read Luther and you read the Reformers, they were all for that. That's really what they were saying. They wanted to get the church to be what it was in the first century. That's very much their idea. But really, where they were mostly coming from was to get all the corruption and greed and covetousness and immorality out of the church, out of the Catholic Church, get it back to the moral, pure church that you read about in the first century. That was the idea. It wasn't as much about we need to reorganize the whole church and get rid of all these other doctrines. We just need to clean up the mess that is the Roman Catholic Church. But they began to do it by making a plea to the scriptures and saying, what you're teaching is not the scriptures say. When Thomas Campbell says, when the Bible speaks, we speak. Where it is silent, we are silent. He was basically stating the same principle that Ulrich Zwingli, who lived in Luther's time, had stated also, not in those very words, but expressing the idea that what is not expressly authorized in scripture is not acceptable. Luther was willing to be more liberal on that and say only what is not expressly condemned is whatever is not expressly condemned is acceptable. So it's not a new idea, but what is different when you get to the Restoration Movement, you get to Thomas and Alexander Campbell and these guys, they're not applying it to Catholicism. They're applying it to Protestantism because the same problem now exists that it had existed back during the Reformation. That is, the denominations had developed to where they were practicing all kinds of things you couldn't read about in the Bible. They were full of faction and division, and its own ministers are reading the Bibles for themselves and saying, wait a minute, this group I'm a part of, it isn't following what the scriptures say. They don't have the matter and spirit of New Testament Christianity. And this is what these men are doing. They're calling for restoration to come out of, not Catholicism, but out of denominationalism, to bring men back to first century Christianity. That's what's revolutionary about what they're doing. They're calling for restoration, not just reformation, and that it was going to involve not being able to reform Presbyterianism or reform Anglicanism. No, it was going to take a restoring of putting away all these creeds and all these governments and hierarchies of churches, and to go back and say the Bible alone is our authority and we will follow it alone, setting all this other aside. That's what not had been done. That is what had not been done by the reformers. So we're entering a period of where people are truly saying, we're going to go back to the Bible and follow it alone. So this is what we're looking at as the background and setting for the Restoration Movement. As I said, it appears in many places. It's developing back in Scotland. We've already seen the tie that Campbell and Thomas and Alexander Campbell both have to Scottish men pleading for that. It will develop in England also. And later, again, it will reappear on the continent. But in America, the idea begins to spring up in several different places. The plea to say, let's go back to the Bible alone. I mentioned a couple of the earlier ones in our lesson. One of the earliest involved James O'Kelly in Virginia. He was a Methodist minister, but he was not a happy Methodist minister. He developed a reputation as being somewhat of a troublemaker among the Methodists because he objected to so many things that they were doing that he said were not scriptural, that were not to be found in the Bible. And he began to make a plea for a return to the Bible as the only authority and return to the Bible forum, a church organization. Methodism in this country, it was early on called the Methodist Episcopal Church because it still wanted to retain much of the episcopal form of government. John Wesley, for a long time, organized his societies within the Anglican Church, not wanting to leave it. And so you had the Methodist Episcopal Church. And O'Kelly complained about so much of it, got himself in trouble a lot with the synods and the leaders. But what finally happened was in 1793, along with a lot of preachers, and actually several thousand members of churches, he severed ties with the Methodist Episcopal Church. Began to call themselves the Republican Methodists. But they continued to study, and wasn't long until they decided that name wasn't scriptural. And they began to refer to themselves simply as the Christian Church, using the term Christian. The plea, the principle is clearly there. He even breaks off from the denomination in order to start this group because he felt they could not remain a part of the Methodist Episcopal Church and practice what the New Testament said. And so they make the plea, the biblical plea of the Bible alone, get back to basic New Testament organization in the church. And the movement becomes very strong for some time. It was practicing many still denominational doctrines during this time. And later it will split, and there will be a lot of its members that go into other restoration movements or groups during this time. So it really doesn't survive, but O'Kelly is an example of one in America who understands the restoration plea and is defending it powerfully and trying to lead people out of denominationalism back to simple New Testament Christianity. So that's happening in the late 1700s, late 1780s, 1790s. Remember again, at that point, we're almost 20 years from Thomas and Alexander Campbell arriving in this country. The other one I wanted to mention is in the New England states at the turn of the 19th century, 1800. Two men, Abner Jones and Elias Smith, are involved in making this restoration plea very strongly up in that area. In 1801, in Vermont, Abner Jones organizes what he calls a free church, where he rejected the denominational ties and broke out, declaring the independence and autonomy of the local church, and saying, we will operate on the basis of the Bible and the Bible alone, and strongly made that plea. Many churches were established in that area upon the basis of what he taught and as a result of his work. Elias Smith joins him in a couple of years. And Elias Smith makes the same plea. Elias Smith had also experienced religious dissatisfaction and actually had begun to drift toward the idea of Unitarianism, Universalism, which is not what it is today, particularly. Unitarianism is not even on the radar as far as the Bible, belief and practice. But it was a movement that came to believe in a universal kind of salvation, that eventually all would end up in heaven. And his love of unity and wanting there to be unity actually resulted in him drifting back toward that. But for a time, he worked with Abner Jones up there, making the basic restoration plea, rejecting Calvinism, saying we're going to only go by the name Christian and use the Bible and the Bible alone. So I said, Smith eventually goes back into Unitarianism. And this group will eventually disappear. But they are planting seeds. They're planting seeds in the hearts of people about the importance of New Testament biblical authority. And many preachers are hearing this plea and understanding it and are beginning to take stands that are biblical in nature of saying, we reject the creeds of men. We're going to go back and just study the Bible. And we're going to just follow that. They begin to reject the ideas of infant baptism. They begin to reject the ideas of sprinkling and immersion. And they will begin to believe in baptism as being necessary for salvation. They will begin to grasp the concept of the autonomy and independence of the local church, and that bishops or elders oversee only local churches. They begin to practice New Testament worship. Instrumental music will begin to become an issue because churches and denominations are now beginning to use it. And that even will become an issue in the Restoration Disciples of Christ movement in another 50 years. But at this point, this kind of plea is cropping up in many different places throughout the United States. Over time, they will begin to learn about each other, reach out to each other, begin to have fellowship with each other, and the restoration plea will grow, and the number of churches following it will grow tremendously over the next few decades. But the real growth is going to occur beginning with this turn into the 19th century, in the early 1800s, through the work of Barton W. Stone, Thomas and Alexander Campbell, and other men like them. They become tremendous influences. They become men who crystallize the ideas of the movement and stand in a position to be able to disseminate the teaching and the preaching in such a way as to effectively expose it to untold numbers of people who will become simple New Testament Christians. And that's what the 1800 to 1850s are about. And that's really what we want to look at next as we look into this. That's a natural breaking point, stopping point for us here. And I think that's where I am going to try to stop tonight. I'll give you an extra 7 minutes here. I'll probably take it back next week, but that's where we are. Does anyone have any questions or comments? Any thoughts? Okay. Well, all right then. We'll stop there. As I say, we'll begin right at about 1800 next time and begin to look at what are some more familiar parts of church history for us as we look at the time of the Restoration Movement in America. I hope that I have time at the end of the class, I'm pretty sure I am, that we're going to look not just at the Restoration Movement in America, but I want to take a lesson where we will look and see what else was happening religiously in America during this time period, besides what was happening in the Restoration Movement. I think that'll be helpful. And we're going to try to bring it up all the way in modern times. Okay? All right. Well, thanks for listening, and hope that you'll join us again on Friday night. See you guys.